Given the suffocating heat, you might not feel like working in the garden today, but we thought mid-July, at the height of summer, when everything seems to be in full bloom, would be the perfect time to devote a Please Explain segment to green things, particularly the things that you don't have to plant or tend to. Weeds. Joining us are Kristen Schleider, the curator of outdoor gardens and herbaceous collections at the New York Botanical Gardens, and Lars Anderson, a plant physiologist and expert on weeds and invasive plant species with the USDA Agricultural Research Service, the Exotic and Invasive Weed Research Laboratory at the University of California, Davis. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Lars, what makes a weed a weed? Who decides that a particular plant should be labeled a weed?
Well, sort of like the old adage of the beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Sort of the weediness or the obnoxiousness of a plant's in the eye of the person who's kind of looking at it and what they'd like to do. So it's pretty much a human value designation or a social value. And if you're growing a weed in your garden you don't like, you pull it out. And if a crop is being produced and it's being interfered with by plants, you try to get rid of those. So it's kind of a human judgment.
From nature's point of view, don't all plants just want to survive and thrive?
Well, they sure do, and that's one of the reasons that some of these become so invasive, because there's a natural tendency for them to reproduce, of course, and to disperse.
So, Kristen, are they just more efficient plants, better at reproducing or surviving?
Well, a lot of them have developed ways of just having tons of seed, or maybe they would love to thrive in compacted soil or soil that's just been disturbed, and they can just get a foothold right away and go to town while the plants you're trying to get to grow there just aren't able to make that competition.
And some of them must grow super fast. There's one that I think is even called Mile a Minute.
Yeah, that's a vine from Asia, and it's a little bit of an exaggeration. It may grow about half a foot a day, and that's still quite fast. But it's able to climb up and smother other plants and basically block out light that they need for photosynthesis. So it's a major problem. It was introduced in the late 1800s.
I wish my tomato plants could grow a half a foot a day.
With big tomatoes, too.
If someone knows nothing about plants and is looking at a garden full of green leaves and stems, would it be apparent simply by looking whether some of those plants might be considered weeds?
Well, as Lars said, it really is in the eye of the beholder. Some things like Queen Anne's lace, for instance, people think are lovely, but if it's in the middle of your very formal perennial garden, you might consider it a weed and want to pull it out.
Or dandelions or daisies.
Exactly. So many things. Or violets in the lawn, right? Some people love them. Other people go mad trying to get them gone. But then there are some things like crabgrass or garlic mustard that I think most people find objectionable and just want to get out as fast as they can.
And then there's kudzu, which kind of has taken over large tracts of America, hasn't it?
Yes, that's especially in the southeast. But the interesting thing about kudzu is that it's also now been found in Canada, which is really unusual. And this kind of points to some of the issues we're concerned about climate change.
Because climate change is encouraging certain weeds to proliferate?
Well, it's changing several things. First of all, the carbon availability is going up. CO2, everyone knows, is rising. Of course, these plants utilize CO2 for their growth. But it's also the increase in temperature. So what we're seeing in some areas is that plants that normally were found at lower latitudes, where it's cooler, where it's warmer, actually, are moving to the higher latitudes, where it's actually now getting warmer. And likewise, we're seeing some movement to higher elevations. So it's having some discernible effects already.
And you also study invasive aquatic plants.
That's right.
Are they being affected by climate change as well?
Well, that's a little bit of a question right now, because certainly in terms of temperature, we're seeing probably some movement of aquatic plants to areas where it's warmed up a little bit, and so there's a more suitable habitat. The question of carbon and CO2 is still out being investigated, whether it's going to have a dramatic effect or not. But clearly, if water and lakes are warming in the higher latitudes, some of the plants are going to do better there.
Now, Kristen, in the outdoor gardens at the New York Botanical Garden, how do you deal with the fact that some of our favorite flowers, like daisies, and there are wildflowers as well, are weeds? Can you plant them and just keep them under control?
Yeah, it really depends on which garden they're popping up in. There are some gardens where we're really encouraging the native flora that some people might consider weeds to grow and to thrive. And there are other gardens where we're being very careful about the palette of plants that's in there where we remove them. So it really is on a case-by-case basis.
Well, can you put dandelions next to daisies and say, fight it out?
You could do, sure.
But what happens if you put something like a dandelion, which is a rather lovely flower, next to some other flowers that we wouldn't call weeds? Are they just going to take over?
No, I don't think so. It really, you know, specifically with a dandelion, you're going to find more of them popping up. It isn't as aggressive as a lot of other weeds are. And, you know, it has that very long taproot, and it just tends to be where it is. It doesn't spread by rhizomes as well. And it's those ones that are rhizomatous and form really dense colonies that are particularly difficult in a garden setting.
Some are called parasitic or noxious. What would a parasitic weed do?
Well, the parasitic weeds very often will be attracted through chemical communication to a host plant where they attach and then actually use the nutrients in the host plant. And many of these have very little or no photosynthesis capacity. They have no chlorophyll. So those can be dramatic effects on those crop plants. For example, corn has a parasite, and it could have a parasite that affects its growth. And so these kinds of weeds are very, very specialized in their interactions with the host. And one of the ways to deal with those is to figure out what those communication pathways are and try to disrupt them.
My guests are Lars Anderson and Kristen Schleider, and we're talking about weeds on today's Please Explain. I guess weeds and invasive species, I don't know if there's a difference. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is there a difference?
Well, invasive species is a general group of all organisms that are have the capacity to move from their center of origins to, for example, to the U.S. from other continents. And weeds are just a subset of that, sort of a subcategory of invasive species. So there's invertebrates, there's certainly vertebrates, reptiles, snakes, for example. They all are in the same category of invasive species. But weeds are a special group, and they're quite prevalent, and they're very difficult to deal with.
Well, kudzu can be destructive. I've read about something called purple loosestrife that was of enormous concern for some time.
It still is. Purple loosestrife actually was introduced in the late 1800s, early 1900s in the Northeast, and in New York and Vermont were the first to experience its spread. It produces thousands of seeds. Each flower can produce thousands of seeds, and it grows pretty tall. Basically, it replaces the native vegetation in aquatic sites. So waterfowl don't have a place to nest, and their normal food sources disappear. But now it's spread to 48 states within the U.S., and it's become, even in California, we have found it about 10 years ago. So it's a very aggressive plant, and the seeds in the plant is spread through flowing water. So it's attractive. It has those typical characteristics of many of these plants, which people like to grow. But unfortunately, it's also prolific and outcompetes the native plants.
And, Kristen, can't trees be weeds as well? There is a tree that is very common throughout the New York area, especially in Brooklyn, where I grew up, that seems to just come out of every crack.
Well,
and I understand it came over from Japan at the end of the 19th century.
We have a tree, actually, that we've had large invasive issues with in our native forest here. We have a 50-acre forest, and we have removed over 800 of these trees, which is the Amur cork tree.
Mm-hmm.
And the trees are so large, they're 6 inches or larger at breast height. We've removed 800 of those and just countless, you know, load after load after load of seedlings. So trees can most definitely be very, very invasive.
Is bamboo a weed?
Yeah, bamboo, there's relations or relatives of bamboo that are extremely weedy. And one of the grasses that we work with out in the western states and in Texas is called a rundo or a giant reed. It looks like a big bamboo and it can grow 20 to 30 feet tall. It's one of those examples where it's the eye of the beholder, because if you play woodwind instruments, you're dependent on this plant for the reeds.
Mm-hmm.
It's used for that. But if you're concerned about flood control and fires and protecting riverine systems, this plant is extremely aggressive and causes huge problems out in western aquatic sites and river systems.
So things could have both positive and negative effects on the environment. We would talk about invasive things. What happens when a fisherman puts on the same old hip waders in a new trout stream? Can he carry seeds of plant life from one area to another?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, it's when it comes down to it, we're probably the most important and most effective vector for moving these plants around. And it's both the seed, it's also fragments of the plants. The other important vector is boats for aquatic plants. We're finding, and people have demonstrated, that for moving these aquatic plants around, boats and boat trailers are one of the most important pathways and vectors.
Now, Kristen, we talked about these invasive plants, but they're also native plants. Some of them are just natural to a habitat, others, I guess, are weeds that are natural to a habitat.
Sure. There are lots of native species that are wonderful to see on the side of the road that you might not want in your garden or in your pasture land, like the common milkweed is beautiful when you see it, mm-hmm. You know, with its pods that are all full of fluff in the fall. But it can be very, very dangerous for livestock to eat. And it also makes huge masses quickly and will just crowd out lots of things in a perennial garden.
Now,
so that's a great example.
I would assume poison ivy is a local plant because it's everywhere. Some just popped up in a pot that was growing cucumbers. How does that happen?
Birds eat the seeds and then drop the seeds.
So the same kind of natural process that leads to good pollination can also lead to that.
Absolutely.
But before we take calls and go to a little break, by the way, our number here is 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Let's just address the whole matter of combating weeds or controlling invasive plant species. Is it possible to do it without creating some kind of environmental damage?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's one of those things that it takes a lot of research to figure out, first of all, why these plants do what they do, how do they reproduce, and how do they disperse. But yes, you can do this. The range of tools runs from physical removal, especially if you can find a plant very early in its infestation stage, to later on using a combination of what we would call integrated methods with mechanical removal, perhaps herbicides, and even biological control. There are some cases of successful eradication. There's two. One's an aquatic plant called hydrilla, which California has successfully eradicated. And another is actually a marine algal species called Caulerpa. And that was also found in California in 2000, and it took 6 years and $7 million to eradicate it, but it's gone.
Well, if you just pull a weed out of the ground, it's almost guaranteed another one's going to pop up in the same place. So when you weed a place, are you still leaving seeds or something that's just going to grow back?
Yeah, it depends on the plant, and that's also a very good point. We call that sort of a seed bank or a propagule bank. And if you know that there's a bank that's going to last, say, 3 to 5 years, you know you're in for a long-term control or eradication program. So, yes, very much you need to know how long the seeds or any propagules, such as a tuber, will last. But typically, these plants have multi-year staying power, so these are long-term programs.
Now, Kristen, we recently discussed the decline in bee populations around the country and around the world, in fact. And one of the causes given is the heavy use of chemicals and genetic modification to control weeds. Are there any weed killers that are friendlier to the environment?
Your hands, I think, are probably the best ones. You just have to pull and dig. You can burn. You can use vinegar. And boiling water actually is great. If you have a sidewalk or driveway with cracks in it and weeds growing in the cracks, just pour some boiling water on, and that does a nice job. But really, the best way is good old-fashioned on your hands and knees and pull them out and make sure you get the root.
Make sure you get all the roots, so maybe you want to pull a little soil out with it.
Yep.
Kristen Schleider is curator of Outdoor Gardens and Herbaceous Collections at the New York Botanical Gardens, and Lars Anderson is a plant physiologist and expert on weeds and invasive plant species with the USDA Agricultural Research Service. And we invite your calls at 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985. Or go to the WMIC website and click on the Leonard LoPage Show and follow the instructions and leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We'll be right back. And we're back with today's Please Explain, talking about weeds with Lars Anderson and Kristen Schleider. And we're taking your calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And let's go to a couple of those calls, beginning with Richard from Harlem. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
I'm okay.
Good. I have a couple of good questions or something that I'd like some clarification
Well,
on.
We love good questions.
Good. I have this huge Elianthus tree that grows in my neighbor's backyard. It's been growing there. 10 years ago, it was only about two stories high. Now it towers over all the brownstones in our area. In fact, I can see it on the satellite imagery when I go to Google Earth. And I was told by somebody at the Botanical Gardens that the roots travel as far as the limbs of the tree go out. And so in my yard, I try to grow tomatoes and I try to grow other things. And I had a pear tree and a plum tree. And what happens is they're dying. And it seems to me that it puts out some kind of poison that sort of, you know, kills trees or plants that it doesn't like. And I wondered if they had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, Kristen, that was what I was asking for about before. Isn't that originally a Japanese tree?
You know, I'm not that familiar with that tree.
Yeah. It's a Chinese tree. It was brought in because it grew all over China, so somebody brought some plants here. It's the actual tree that the story, a tree grows in Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
And everywhere else, obviously.
And, everywhere else. I mean,
Lars, do you know about it?
Yeah, that's Tree of Heaven, and it is a very aggressive tree. And when you're at that stage where you have a big tree like that, you're really kind of stuck either trying to remove it physically and then try to get the roots out, or I don't know what else you could do, because when you trim back the branches, it just keeps growing more and more. We pull these out with what's called a like a tree wrench when they're quite small saplings. But when you have a tree your size, I think you've got a really difficult situation there. Maybe talk with a neighbor about getting rid of it.
But what about Richard's other idea that the tree prevents other things from growing in the area?
Well, there's a kind of a concept and an understanding about plant interaction and where chemicals can be released from one plant and affect another. It's called allelopathy. That plant, I'm not sure if that has been demonstrated, but it does have some toxic materials that it produces in its leaves. It may be that you're really getting mostly a shading effect in addition to nutrients that it's taking from the soils.
Okay, Richard?
Yeah, pretty much. I found a way to grow grass in my backyard, but my tomato plants just don't do anything, and other things just don't do anything. So if they have some thoughts on it, but thanks anymore for the information.
Well, the answer is either to get rid of it, obviously, if that's possible, or to live with it, right? Kristen, you said.
He could try growing tomatoes in pots. If you really want to have tomatoes, get some very, very large pots, and then you won't have to worry about the roots robbing the nutrients and the moisture from the soil. And you can put the pot in the sunniest spot that you've got, and you should get some successful tomatoes.
Now, don't tomatoes grow very well with marigolds? Is there some reason for that? Maybe I got that wrong.
Yeah, well, no, that is definitely traditional wisdom that they do. And they attract a lot of pollinators into the area, which is terrific for getting your tomatoes to fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And the scent of marigolds is repellent to some insects as well. So I think that's where that comes from.
Let's take another call. This is from Bob in Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, you were speaking about bamboo earlier, and I like bamboo, but I understand the bamboo roots, some of the plants can be really dangerous. They could break foundations. They can travel 30, 40, 50 feet or more. So is there a type of bamboo that isn't dangerous like that?
There is. There is a genus of bamboo called Fargesia that gets quite tall, different species, different heights, but up to, 16 feet or so, and it's clumping. I've had one in my backyard for about 16 years now, and it's about 6 feet across. So it really stays beautifully put, and it's gorgeous, and you get the wonderful rustling noise, and birds love to hide in it, so it provides great habitat.
And how are the roots?
The roots seem to be fine. I have other plants growing right up under it and next to it, and they're doing fine. So it seems to be really an easy plant to get along with in the garden.
And no danger to foundations, because I understand that's a big problem of some bamboo plants.
I think what they're talking about are some of the ones that are very strongly spreading, and I've seen them come up, you know, through sidewalks and through roadways. So that's the sort of plant that's going to be a problem into your foundation.
Thank you for calling. Ruth from Rockville Center, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I think that the word weed is getting in the way in your discussion.
It's getting in the way?
Yeah, I think you need to.
You think it's too invasive?
No, because some weeds, there are invasive plants that don't belong here that take over. And there are other plants that we just call weeds because people don't want them in their gardens. For example, I have a place in my yard where I let grow something called pokeweed, and most people would just get rid of it. But I like it because it gets berries that the birds love. And a lot of plants that we go out and buy are really wildflowers, which you could call those weeds, too. So I think...
Or morning glories, which many people love to plant, and they're weeds, aren't they?
Sure. Morning glories can be very weedy, and particularly in cropland environments. There's a lot of effort that goes into keeping morning glories out of crop production areas because they interfere with the crop yield. But I think you're quite right. It really depends, again, on the eye of the beholder. If you like a plant, the only concern that some of us have is that some of the most attractive plants that people like to grow also have these characteristics of rapid growth and dispersal and reproduction and high competition against native plants that make them problems. We've had so many escapes from both crop production plant areas, but also just from hobbyists who are growing plants, and particularly those who are putting in backyard ponds. It's amazing how many plants have escaped from those kinds of areas that are now weeds in natural systems.
Is one way to fight them to eat them, Kristen? I've heard that there are some very interesting recipes for eating weeds like kudzu salad and Japanese knotweed crumble.
Well, I have to say, I have not tried any of those recipes, but if it makes there be less Japanese knotweed in the world, I am all for it.
I've also heard that goats are very good about consuming weeds. Of course, it's not so easy to keep a goat in an urban environment.
Well, I have a friend, actually, who does have a goat, and their yard is really quite clean, but the goat not only eats the weeds, he eats everything else he can lay his teeth on. You have to really want a minimalist garden to go for the goat.
Or else have a lot of weeds.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Goats and lambs have been used, and sheep have been used out here in California to control weeds. They move them into different areas for a few weeks, then take them off, and it helps protect some of the native plants that way.
Now, I never followed up on your description of the destruction of certain invasive things in California, I guess it was, in the water. What did they do? Did they use explosives? How did they get rid of them?
Not quite. Well, when we eradicated the marine algal species, we basically covered it with large tarps and put small sort of pucks of chlorine, the same kind of tablets you put in your pool, for example, and it was actually quite effective. This marine algae actually took over the Mediterranean Sea quite a bit. It took off around the 1980s and has expanded to around 40,000 acres over there. So the people in California were extremely concerned about it getting into the open coast here. So that program started right away, and it's a good example of doing what we call a rapid response, where it was covered. Within 3 weeks of its discovery, we were covering it and treating it.
Now, once you pull the weed out, what do you do with it? You can't put it in your compost pile, can you? A listener asks about doing something like that. Can rhizomes and seeds rot enough to be dead?
Yeah, that depends on the plant again also. Some of these seeds will last 10, 20, and 30 years or more.
And so that is a question, and I think it depends. You really have to know the species and a little bit about its longevity, the seed longevity. But a lot of these will rot pretty fast in a compost pile, and then if you don't put that pile back on your garden right away, you may have a chance of using it. But I think that it is a bit of a risk.
So what do you do with it? Just throw it in the garbage?
These go to landfills typically, and that's where most of the weed material goes that have been pulled out from infested areas. In aquatic sites, these tend to, when they're treated, they'll decompose in those aquatic systems over several weeks.
I would think at a landfill they'd be doing good because they'd be helping enrich the soil.
That could be the case because those landfill areas, of course, get shifted around. Once they reach capacity, they cover them over, and then the natural microbial processes go to work in there.
Let's take another call. This one from Chris from Belmore, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. my question is about weed that I have in my backyard. I really think it does qualify as a weed. I think most people would think it is, hopefully, because it's a vine that is covered with thorns, and I believe that it is called greenbrier. I think that's the common name, or smilax. But what it does is it spreads by these horrible runners coming out from sort of a big rhizome that starts in the middle and then branches out and can go underground for 20 feet or 10 feet, and I can't figure out how to get rid of it. As many of the vines that I dig out, I have to go back to the bulb, and it's hard to find the big bulb. So once you break the vine, that's it.
Any response, Kristen?
I don't want to use chemicals on it. And I would have to literally, I think, dig up my entire backyard.
Yeah, that's a very, very sort of a deep and also massive rhizome that it produces. So you really have to do some digging there. There are perhaps some herbicides you could consider using, but I think the trick would be to try to dig that thing up as much as you can and then keep digging it back. The rhizome is the storage part of the plant, and if you keep removing the top, eventually you could wear out that rhizome so it won't reproduce anymore, won't put up another shoot. But that's a long-term, you're in for a long-term project, I think.
And along those lines, Madeline from Wilton, Connecticut writes, until 10 or fewer years ago, I'd never laid eyes on garlic mustard. Now it's all over the place. I pull, mow, and herbicide is to no avail. I've heard that it is destructive to butterfly and moth life. Can you explain how?
That plant is spreading around pretty fast. It's it has some compounds that it releases and deters those insects. In terms of control, I think there's some active research going on to control garlic mustard right now. We have folks in our area out here, the UC Davis Weed Research Group, that's looking at that as well.
So a plant can actually hurt butterflies?
It can affect their ability to get to the plants they normally utilize.
I've heard that certain plants will attract bees and butterflies, and others will attract regular flies because of their odors. But I never heard that they actually can hurt as well.
The other thing is that, and this is typical of a lot of these invasive plants, is they begin to outcompete for space, the native plants, and so after a while, the native plants that the insects and other animals perhaps depend on no longer are there. So there's a real threat to just the native population of plants from some of these invasive plants that come in from other continents.
Tony from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I own property in Texas on Lake Conroe and waterfront, and that lake originally was taken off of them by hydrilla, and they introduced amwa to eat the hydrilla, and said that they couldn't reproduce and they would die. Well, they didn't. So they ate everything in the lake, and it stopped the fish from growing because they had no place to hide. The second thing they got was giant salvinia, which is an invasive plant that has no predator except in South America, which is a beetle that bores into its stem, and they're trying to introduce that, and I'm worried about how that's going to go. And a third thing that most people don't realize, that your beautiful lily pad is an invasive plant in a lake. it'll take over a lake. There's a Sheldon Reservoir is 10 miles east of Houston, and you cannot canoe through it because the water hyacinth is so thick it totally took over the reservoir.
Well, you've hit the three most important aquatic weeds that we deal with in the U.S. all in one swipe, and Texas certainly has them. You're right. Lake Conroe in Texas was one of the first large trials of the grass carp, which is the fish you're talking about, and it was basically overstocked. And in the time between that was first done and the current process and procedures now, there's a whole lot more understanding about numbers of fish to use. But Lake Conroe went from almost 100% hydrilla to zero, but then it shifted into a lot of algae and so on. So it was an extreme case of using a biocontrol agent there. The salvinia you mentioned, which is giant salvinia, is a major problem. This plant can grow on top of each other and create enough density to support a brick on the water and cover the entire surface. And we've had lakes that have been completely inundated with it in one season. It's a very difficult plant.
We're about to run out of time. A listener wants to know whether marijuana is a weed or whether that's just slang.
I say it's both. It depends on where you want it, I guess.
But marijuana is really sisal, isn't it? Isn't it something, or it's something that grows? It's hemp.
Well, yes.
Which is where we can get ropes from as well. Anyway, that's a whole other show. And my thanks to both of you for being with us today, Lars Anderson and Kristen Schleider. We've been talking about weeds and related subjects on today's Please Explain. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, guest host Julie Burstein talks to On Being host Krista Tippett about her new series that looks at how to rebuild civic life in America. And then Nina Sankovic discusses the book she turned to for comfort and escape after her sister's death. Also, why we often misunderstand the motives behind shoplifting. Plus, Don Cheadle discusses playing an FBI agent in the dark comedy The Guard, in which he becomes half of an unlikely team investigating murder, blackmail, drug trafficking, and police corruption. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakely Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Inkins, the executive producer. We had help today from William Miesmer, Kevin Sun, and contributing producer Bonnie LeFave. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.